Welcome to the Drama Therapy Collection podcast. This podcast is part of a series on drama therapy in prisons. All interviews are conducted by Cameron Afari, Elizabeth Malone, Lynn Baker Newman, and Marianne Shrine. The Drama Therapy in Prisons Collection is an open access online oral history archive of recorded interviews with drama therapists who worked in carceral settings and formerly incarcerated individuals who participated in those programs. For more information about all hosts and guests, please visit the links in the podcast bio. Today's guest is Daniel Whitlow.
Daniel, thank you so much for being here. It's really wonderful to have you here today. The question one is, tell us about your experience with performance work in a carceral setting. So let's just start with that one. In other words, if you can just remember all the ways in which, and if this can be just a laundry list at this point, you don't have to really go into, you know, the earlier discussion that we had, but just like, how many performances have you participated in? What were these performances? Maybe if you can remember any titles, people that you worked with, years would be nice. Any information that can help us document the work that you've done in performance.
Sure. Well, thank you for the question. And I think that you articulated my Instagram performance much better than I did, just in the few minutes that you just said it. So the performance work that I've done has largely been musical. I'm not much of an actor or a performance artist in that sense, a physical performance artist. But the Cal State performances are on the list, certainly. The Imagine That performance and the other one that was done during the graduation or during the year celebration last year. And then they had, obviously, the Words Uncaged play that we did with Susan Cain, If Freedom Was a Mile Away. But there was other performances that I did before that, most of which were musical. Some were related to classes that I took where I had an opportunity to be able to write music specific to a piece of a class or a performance in a class. We had an acting class. Basically, it was an acting class. It was an English class, really, but with Ahmad Jackson through Cal State LA. And that ended up also being a performance class as well, because we did reenactments of a few different plays. One of which is the 12 Angry Men, which is a really powerful piece. I think it's a great social commentary. And all the performances that I've done in aggregate all sort of point to the same thing for me. And that's creating new perspectives for me to view myself, creating new perspectives for me to see other people. And I think maybe most importantly of all of them is creating new perspectives for me to see the world. I guess I think it's sort of an oversimplification, but especially with the incarcerated, but I think this applies to everybody. When we go through the process of our lives and we deal with whatever we deal with on a daily basis, we become focused on certain things because we're goal-oriented people. We try to accomplish things in the ways that we want to accomplish them. And we're goal-oriented in that we focus on things. But because of the way that human beings are, we oftentimes focus our energy in negative ways as well. We become obsessive over certain things. Like for myself, I was obsessed in terms of my identity. I was obsessed as being seen as the best musician on Facility A. I was obsessed with being a know-it-all, getting straight A's. I was obsessed with all of these things, and they became like these prerequisites for me to be me. That if I wasn't the best musician or if I wasn't a great student, then I wasn't me any longer. And I felt that became problematic. And in one of the performances that I did, I had an opportunity to play a character who was not very intelligent, and lived in sort of this cloud in the world where nothing made sense. He was confused by everything because he wasn't very smart. He just didn't understand. Playing that role and imagining myself in that role was really humbling. It was humbling because it forced me to see the world through eyes where I didn't have control over my knowledge. I didn't have control over my understanding, where I just had to see the world sort of with this blissful ignorance. And I basically just saw myself in a new light. I saw myself as this person who didn't have what I had, didn't have if you want to call it talent, the talent that I had, or that had the access to the education that I had. And that gave me the perspective that there's a lot of people out there that didn't have what I have. It made me more grateful. And it also humbled me in the sense that I realized that every single day, you know, as a student, as a person, I have to continue to learn. To get away from specifics and just be general about it, the experience of performance in prison and doing performance work in prison is all about creating it's about creating new identities.
Right.
Because the identities that we create as prisoners are very concrete. They're unmoving and they're generally negative. They're based on just a few different things within that world, within that reality, that are hard to change. You can't be a compassionate person because compassion's seen as weakness or vulnerable. You can't be caring. You can't be kind. Those are not strengths. Those are weaknesses. You can't be anything less than ultra masculine. Because if you are anything less than ultra-masculine, you're seen as weak. You're victimized. You're looked down on. You can't be too smart, because if you're too smart, then people are insulted by your intelligence. But you can't be too stupid, because then people look down on you just like they look down on anybody they consider to be stupid. You can't be too much of anything. But oddly enough, prison is a world of extremes. Prison is too much of everything. It's either too much masculinity or too much violence or too much anything. All of those things is too much. There's too much racial separation. There's too much power. There's too much control. There's too much hate. There's too much all of these things. But the people that are in prison, in order to be able to fit in, can't be too much of anything. You have to sort of walk this fine line in the middle. And it creates this very contradictory existence, and ultimately is very frustrating, I think. And so when people get frustrated and they don't know who to be, then they just mimic those around them. And that does create this sort of cyclical destruction, self-destruction, where you're no longer yourself, you're somebody else. You swing towards extremes constantly, back and forth. And trauma eventually takes over and controls you and makes all your decisions for you. And then that leads you to becoming sort of that poisoned carbon copy of who you used to be, that now only sees things through distorted eyes.
Thank you so much. Yeah, well, we're going to come back to this last part of your discussion for sure. And thank you for that. I want to ask you, and we talked about this a little bit, if you can share musically some of your work, some of it, you know, like examples of how you were working through some of these issues in your music, in your lyrics as well too. And we talked about maybe you can share some shorter pieces with us, and then we'll edit in some of your longer, more recorded, you know, produced pieces. So I don't know if that's something that this is a good time to ask you to maybe share some of those, that, you know, music, some of the lyrics of the work that you produced in these different performances, just examples or incidents of, you know, how you came up with something. I know one example was the work that you did with Jeff Stein, that one song that had to do with testing in a relationship and jealousy. And there was some back and forth in the class about, you know, how you would respond if you found out that someone is testing you in an intimate relationship. And then you and Jeff created this beautiful song that was, you know, a sort of an honoring the other person, honoring of your own boundaries. So I'm sure you have dozens of examples of that.
Do I? So music has always been my, I'm not going to say that it's my favorite, but it's probably been my primary mode for expressing and working through emotional things, emotional difficulties, mainly because writing for me is very cathartic, very specific. I tend to be very specific with my words. And that's good. And that's why I like pairing lyrics with music. I think that's why most musicians like using words with music, because the words can be specific. The music is, for me, is very general. That's very kind of nebulous. I don't give the music any specific attention in terms of expressing ideas. I just let it kind of sound as it sounds, right? Because it's so subjective. Music is so subjective that 100 people can hear a song and hear it, feel and experience 100 different things, very, very different things. So I know that music as a expressive device is extremely easy, because you could just, you know, make noise and you feel something and that's it. But for other people hearing it, I think music becomes more of a mystery. They kind of have to find whatever it is that they feel when they listen to it. So that requires a little bit of self-reflection. It requires a little self-exploration. So I think there's a really cool dynamic between the musician and the listener. The musician wrote something specifically so that people can feel whatever it is they're going to feel. And through that music, that musician is expressing themselves. Everyone else feels completely different things. And it doesn't need to be connected to the music or the musician at all. It can just be whatever they wish. I think that that's a really powerful tool, a really powerful collective tool. And I'm really glad that I've had the opportunity to just play for people, write music, and express myself through the music. I'm also really, really shy about my music for the most part. It takes pretty Herculean efforts on my part to become comfortable with it. When we were working on the play with Elizabeth for the Imagine That, and the other play with the Cal State guys, I think it took me like 3 hours of talking myself up to even just being a part of it, because I was really shy. I had never really done anything like that before. And the thing that changed it with the guy that I was living with at the time, he's like, man, don't you go to the band room every weekend for like 10 hours and play in front of people there? And I said, yeah, but this is different. You know, this is a performance with the, you know, there's volunteers that are coming in, there's teachers, that's Cal State. And he's like, no, it's no different. It's the same exact thing. You do the same exact thing every weekend in the band program. And they're just asking you to take some time and to be more meticulous and to do the same thing. So when he gave me that dose of perspective, it was good. I was able to sort of relax and kind of ease into it. And I think that that's part of the reason why music's so important. It's very personal. Music's very personal. And I think that I was at the point where sharing something that personal with a group of people was still intimidating. And I think it's just because naturally we're intimidated when we share private emotions, private feelings, thoughts. I mean, had I not explained my music to anybody, nobody would have known what I was talking about. But there was still the fear that the fear and the shyness that was associated with it that I think makes music a really powerful medium. That as a musician, I can feel such trepidation about sharing something that nobody outside of it would ever know unless I told them. And so that there's a lot of honesty there, and it's, I think it's really important. And my lyrics have always tried to be really honest. I've always tried to be really honest with them. I don't generally rhyme. I'm not a particularly good poet. I don't follow any of the rules. I'm also like hyper obsessive about imagery in my writing, but I'm more consumed with the words being as honest as possible. I have some poetry that I'll tell you that has been borderline suicidal, with people have read it and have been really, really worried about me, and have concerned themselves with me for, you know, just to make sure that I'm not, you know, tripping. And the fact that I was able to put it on paper meant that I had moved past it. The fact that I was able to write about it and talk about it openly meant that I was done with it. But I can see that there is the worry there that people have sometimes with when people start talking about negative themes like that. But as a writer, especially with narrative therapy, you have to be able to talk about things in this really stark, kind of ugly, naked way. And you have to be able to discuss the issues openly. That way you can process them and then come at them in a more positive way. As I mentioned in the Instagram thing, the externalization, I love that. I love that idea of externalization, because human beings are really internal. We're internal creatures. Everything that happens around us, it's like we take it all in. And oftentimes we hold things that aren't really us. We hold things inside. We internalize the positive and the negative aspects of our life every day. So let me give you an example. A couple of days before I was released, there was a guy that was just down the tier that something happened. I never even actually found out what happened, but something happened to him and he was really upset. He was so mad at this thing that he couldn't stop. He was so mad that he was shaking. He had sweat pouring down his face. He was so angry. And I came down to him and I asked him, man, are you all right, dude? Like you seem like you're pretty upset right now. And he explained that, you know, there was somebody in another building that had done something and they owed him money and they didn't pay him on time and, you know, and all this stuff. And he's talking about how, you know, if he respected me, he would have paid me. And it was all about him. He kept saying, me, me, me. It was my fault. He didn't pay me because of me. And I've seen this time and time again in prison with people. And it makes sense, because they live lives where, I don't want to say they're the victim, but they're always they're always the fault. They're always the reason that things go wrong. And after you think that for so long, you can't help but believe it. That just becomes the norm. I'm the problem. There are no solutions. It's just me. I'm me, and everything goes to crap around me because of it. And I told him afterwards, I said, my brother, that guy made that choice because he has his own thing going on. But what do you have going on? What's going on in your life that has you so angry that you're using this scenario that's not connected to you in any way, except because of some debt for a couple of bucks this guy owes you? What's going on in your life that makes you feel like somehow this is all your fault? And we had a chance to sit down and talk about it. His mom's really sick. He's got stuff going on out there that he can't control. He feels at a loss because he doesn't understand his life. He doesn't understand what's going on. He's got life without. All of these things that he has internalized are poisoning every moment of his existence because he's taking it all on himself. My message to him ultimately was, look, bro, you are only responsible for a tiny number of those things. So I told him that those decisions that you make to come to prison are your responsibility. But everything else other than that is not. I told Noel Wright about it. He was in my creative writing class, and I think he did. And basically all he did in his writing was, and he told me later, is he talked about this debt as being this like ball of black energy. And he was holding the ball of black energy like up near him. And he could feel like this sensation on his face from it that was this negative. It was this prickling kind of negativity. And he set it on a table or something away from him, and he sat back and he looked at it, and he no longer felt it, but he saw it for what it was. And he wrote this, I thought, a kind of a clever idea to approach a poem, where it's just taking a negative thing and setting it aside and no longer seeing it as negative, but rather just as a thing. And I thought he did a really good job of doing that. And I think writing has that ability. I think that writing allows us to be very specific in how we push something away, how we externalize it, how we see it. Whereas with music, I think it just creates sort of a kind of an ambiguous atmosphere for it to happen.
Marianne, Elizabeth, Lynn.
So Daniel, thank you so much. I could listen to you for a long time. So you started the interview talking about in the beginning, your identity was more focused on external feedback, and you were very concerned about your identity and your music. And then there was some kind of shift, the focus of how you became more humbled. I'm trying to understand where how this shift is, like what feeds your identity now versus before.
As a young person, I had no self-respect, and my esteem was based solely on the opinions of others. I held a lot of resentment towards my father and stepfather for abandoning me. Both of them abandoned me in different ways, but they still abandoned me. And I took that on. I internalized that. I took that on as being my fault. And instead of finding a creative or a positive way of expressing myself to move past those feelings of abandonment and resentment, anger, and kind of disconnection, did everything I had to do to get people to like me. And in the process of getting people to like me, I completely lost touch with who I was, my own personal sense of value, my sense of worth. And that started a really, really dangerous and ultimately really terrible process where I just sort of dissolved. And I became only the reflection of my friends, not because I couldn't think for myself, but because I chose to be emotionally chameleonic, where I just wanted to only be what they needed so that I felt needed by them. So I lived this life of constantly looking for people's acceptance as opposed for actually creating my own sense of acceptance for myself. I didn't care about myself. I felt worthless. Well, my music sort of went in the same way. As with all things, artists, I think generally their art mimics them. I think you see into the soul of an artist when you see their work. A lot of artists, I think, show what they see through their art. I think that's really important. That's the way that they express themselves, the way they try to make sense of the maze that they're trapped in is through their artwork. For me, my music does the same thing. It allows me an opportunity to express myself. Well, when I was a really negative, self-hating, immature kid that didn't have any understanding of myself or the world, any appreciation for anything that was going on, my music was the same way. My music was selfish. It was resentful. It was angry. It was violent. It was depressive. It was all of those things and many, many other things. And I needed to find a way for me to start writing music that was more positive and more productive. When I started to understand that I could use my music to do those things, to make those positive changes in myself. Instead of it being an angry testament every time I played music, I could instead make it a healthy, cathartic process.
Maybe if you're comfortable sharing a little bit of like, you know, it seems like so much of what you've found maybe a little bit later, for whatever that means to you, what was that kind of missing piece that you think could have helped you? You touched on it a little bit, growing up, to be able to express yourself healthily.
Well, it wasn't for a lack of trying on my family's behalf. My mom gave me my guitar when I was 7. She is a musician. My grandmother's a singer. So I had, plus my father, my biological father's a musician as well. So it's in my blood too. So it wasn't for a lack of trying on their part. I think that when I stopped caring about myself and started only caring about what other people thought, I think that was really that really represented a much larger disconnection in my life. I stopped doing the things that were healthy for me or that mattered to me at that point. Up until that point, music had been a really good, really healthy thing, and I spent quite a bit of time doing it. After that happened, I really disconnected from everything and only worked on the acceptance from others. And of course, playing guitar and writing, I only did it because other people wanted to hear me play or wanted to read my writing. I think I lost my way because my intention and my reasons for playing music and for writing became distorted through the lens of trauma and disconnection that I was experiencing because of the failed relationship with my father and stepfather. And so I chose to only use music and writing as a way to get friends. As a way to make something unique about myself so that I stand out. So you're right in that it took me a while to get back to that. But it wasn't for a lack of my family trying. They really tried to foster the creative process for me and to create an environment where that was possible. I said earlier that I realized I could use it. I think I re-remembered that I could use music, as opposed to realizing it for the first time. It wasn't an epiphany. It was sort of like, you know, you take the palm and you slap your forehead and you realize, oh man, I forgot this. It's like meeting an old friend again. Suddenly I just remembered that I loved music and I loved writing and I hated feeling like crap all the time. And I figured maybe there was a connection there, a synergy between those elements that I could, you know, use to make myself feel better. I really wish that I had appreciated my artistic upbringing.
I have a question. Like, what would you say now to your 13? The question is, like, what would you be able to say now to your 13-year-old self? Like, is there anybody out there that could have actually reached him?
I think so. I wrote a poem about that, basically just like a 5-minute, it's not really 5 minutes, but I called it 5 minutes with my young self. And it's a really just devastatingly emotional poem. And I didn't read it during the Instagram thing because I would have ended up just crying, sobbing through most of it, like I always do. And in that, but the main part of the poem, and I think, which is the most important, is that there is such a brilliant energy about innocence, and it's temporary. Innocence is ephemeral. We get to a point in our life where we're no longer innocent, and that's not by any doing, it's not by anything of our doing, it's just that life is that way, that we get to a point where we know something, and or we get to a point where we start to understand the world and our innocence goes away. But that doesn't mean that our purity goes away. I would tell my young self that a good life is a pure life, that a good life is one that's lived with purity of thought and heart, that you do the right things for the right reasons, that you observe morality and that you respect people, that you love yourself, the old adage that if you can't love yourself, you can't possibly love others. How would you know? And I would give myself specific examples throughout my life where I made such terrible decisions that ultimately affected everything that I ever loved and everything that I ever cared about for nothing, because you risk destroying everything in the process of hating yourself. But with a little bit of understanding and a little time that we could spend processing, I think that young people would have much healthier lives if they had an opportunity to just understand what was going on in their life.
I think that, and as I'm hearing you speak, I'm wondering too if, you know, your major, like you said, your dad and your stepfather in different ways abandoned you. Like, if we all could have a better understanding of who we are, and we're in a situation where we separate from, you know, our child somehow, or the person, you know, in our marriage, but we have an understanding of how to keep that attachment with our children, you know, because, I mean, you say a lot of like, oh, I made all these poor decisions, but you lost so much. So you were in such a period of grief, and it makes sense. I mean, who wouldn't go toward in some way looking for that attachment elsewhere? You know, and just having a baby right now, I'm thinking a lot about attachment. And I mean, it's so clear how attached she is to me. It's like obsessive, right? And so that, you know, that will go away to a certain extent, but internally it's still there. You know, we are made to attach to our family. It makes sense that when you lose an attachment, even if it's over a slow period or a quick break from the person that as a baby you are, you know, your survival depends on from the people, then it can lead to really, really hard places within us.
Yeah. And I want to, I mean, that's, I don't have any kids. I'm looking forward to that day. I'm sure that it's super rewarding and super tiring. But I do think that there is a lot of wisdom in that idea of that it's not, separation can be really, really good, but it's not disconnection. I think there's often I misunderstood that dynamic between separation and disconnection. Space, distance, those things, they sound insidious. They sound evil. They sound terrible because we don't like them. We don't like being away from the people that we want to be with. You know, there's all sorts of stuff going on there. But separation is good. Separation's good. People need to have their personal space. They need to have, I've always seen it as like people that walk with little bubbles around them all the time. There's no problem for our bubbles to touch. Just so long as our bubbles don't stick to each other and we're constantly stuck. My wife and I are really, really close, but since we married last year, and even just in the 3 years that we've known each other, she and I have spent less than 3 weeks physically together, mainly because I was in prison. And then after I got out, we were together for a couple of weeks, and then she went back to Germany and COVID and all this stuff. But we've managed to make our separation work. One, because we don't really have a choice, and so there's not much we can do about it. But we've made it work because we have created all of these fun little interpersonal dynamics with each other. Our own little language, our own series of symbolic language, you know, symbolic words and things that we share with each other. My point is that you can accomplish the same thing through music and writing.
I have a really wonderful conversation that we just had. I really appreciate this and bringing in the attachment theory and this notions of individuality that's at the same time connected, and the distancing is not the same thing as disconnection. And it's really powerful work. And I wanted to bring us back to the second question that, you know, that I'd like to know from Danielle, your experience of being in a cohort who cohort one or the A yard or the educational cohort where there is education, but where this added component of performance is introduced. And how do you see that experience of adding performance, creating those kind of healthy bonds of connection and separation with the cohort, with others that you worked with? So I'm trying to focus on the way in which adding performance and the performance in the not just theatrical stage performance, but also the kinds of presentations that you would do where you would bring in artistic expression, or the way in which you would then have these added sharing of experience with each other to try to create something artistic. If you could maybe just talk a little bit about that, what kind of value did it create for you? How did it, help you, feel like there's an added dimension there that wouldn't just be there in a straightforward classroom?
I think that ultimately the performances that we put on, that those connections that we created, made me appreciate myself and the men in my cohort more. And it did that through a couple of different ways. The first is I appreciated their emotional intelligence. In incarcerated people tend to not have really healthy modes of emotional expression. It's trauma, it's the institutionalization, arrested development, it's a lot of things. But it's rare to find men with a vulnerable enough sense of themselves to express themselves through that medium. And so that, of course, is a very, very kind of life-affirming, because they're able to express themselves through performance, and you see sort of this raw kind of vulnerable underbelly that they share in their performances, which is great to see, because they're human beings and they are. And as a prisoner, as somebody who was incarcerated, I got so tired of the constant institutional veneer that everybody had, the masks that everybody wore all the time. And it was so redundant, especially after I had been in prison for a time. Everybody wears masks, myself included. And they do it in all these different situations. Irritating. It's irritating because it's false, but yet because you're still stuck in that same institutional system, you still do it. It's so irritating, and it makes no sense. It's such a waste of energy. And the dishonesty is really, really, there is an attrition in life that I've found that is associated with lying and playing a role and wearing a mask. And it is deteriorative inside and out. If I continue to pretend to be somebody that I'm not, not only do I know that I'm not that person, and so therefore have to deal with the negativity of being something that I'm not, basically lying to myself, but then I'm also lying to you. And I also have to feel ashamed for pretending to be something to you that's not real, and then you know it as well. And you have to see me in that light, and that's not good. And you also have to feel that way about yourself too, and wonder about, it's so ridiculous that the system insists on people pretending to be something they're not. Everybody should just be able to be who they are, because that's the most healthy thing. Be who you are and allow other people to see who you are. And to let the conversation be about honesty and about emotional articulacy. And let's talk about that self-efficacy of being who you really are. Let's work through our problems together. Oh, you're a flawed, messed up person? Well, crap, so am I. Let's figure out how we can create solutions together as a team, not only to help each other, but to help ourselves in the process. Let's do the compassionate, intelligent thing, and let's try to help each other move past our problems and find solutions. That's the easiest way for two people to work together. We work together to help each other. And by helping each other, we help ourselves. Prison is not that way. And so when you get a class or any type of program that allows people to do performances, you actually get to see the real them, because it draws out of them in that process. The process of performing, of playing music, of playing a role, even if just reading a script, you get to see a lot of that person. Even if they try to hide it, you still see it. It still comes out. And it was through the performances where I realized that when people would say, hey, man, you know, that performance was awesome, or your song was really cool, man, or I love that poem, or, man, I could see the emotion in your eyes. I could see it in your body. I can see that it mattered. I could see that this was real for you, that what you said was important. It really meant a lot to me. It inspired me to do the same thing. Come on. I mean, that's the best part of performance, in my opinion, is that when you commit yourself to it, it makes you into a better person. Because you're able to feel how you're supposed to feel, the truth. You're able to express the truth. And it leads you to the truth, ultimately. Those men in the cohort, in the first cohort, a lot of them, when we first started that journey, were completely shut down. Most of them, I would say, were completely shut down and were only interested in a bachelor's degree. They only wanted a degree. They just wanted something that would help them get out of prison. I have no judgment. I was in the same boat. I have no judgment at all. I completely agree. I wanted a degree. One, because I wanted to be able to prove to myself that I can do it. And two, because it wouldn't hurt if that opportunity ever came to go in front of the board. It wouldn't be a bad thing. And so my intentions going into it were self-serving. And I would imagine that most of the men had self-serving intentions too. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in the process of doing the classes and really investing myself into it, I learned something that I think, well, I don't think, I know, changed me as a human being. Who I am is my choice. Everything that I am is my choice. When I wake up in the morning, I decide how I'm going to be today and how I'm going to act today. And if my life is filled with shadows and darkened corners where something terrible and evil lurks waiting for me, and I live my life in fear, or I live my life through the lens of trauma, and I let everything that's negative in my life control me, then that's who I'm going to be. And if I'm not willing to discuss those traumatic things, and if I'm not willing to work through my problems, then I'm going to continue to be that person. But if I dare to allow myself to process, to find something healthy to let me work through my problems, to better understand my issues, then I have an opportunity to start developing healthy coping mechanisms, to better understand myself. And the better that I understand myself, the better I'm able to deal with my problems. And when I have more solutions for my problems, then I have less problems. And then I have an opportunity to feel better about myself on a daily basis. I can make the positive decisions that I need to in order to ensure that my life is a good one, a positive one, where I'm helping others, helping myself, doing the right things. I no longer have to live in fear of the traumas that lurk around every corner, that I can just simply be who I am. And ultimately, when I accepted myself as who I was, then I was finally really able to, you know, feel good every morning, wake up and get ready to be a positive person. But it was through those performances and through the music and through the writing and through everything that led me to that point. So this song's, it's called In Disguise. And it's a song that I recorded not too long ago and I shared with Cameron. Basically, it's about my dad. It's about the relationship with my dad and a relationship with myself, just like we talked about earlier. And it's about not having any self-worth, feeling unworthy, understanding that my father is really kind of at the core of that, but still taking it all on myself. It's about that externalization. It's about wearing masks. It's about not allowing myself to be innocent of his decisions, feeling like I'm guilty of them, like I was the one that made his decisions for him, like I deserved them, which I think a lot of kids that go through that type of abandonment, or kids that are caught in where parents are divorced, I think a lot of kids feel like it's their fault, like they didn't do something or did something that was wrong that caused their parents to split up. And they internalize it to make sense of it. They internalize it to make sense of the trauma, for there to be a, because they don't want to blame their parents, right? Some kids do, but most don't, I think. They want to take it on themselves. It's much easier. It was much easier as a young person for me to say that it was my fault than someone else's, because I didn't have to talk to anybody. All I had to do was just look in the mirror and say, "You're ugly. It's your fault." And then it was done. And I internalized it and it was over. I think casting blame on others is more difficult. So it's called In Disguise. And hopefully this is, it's not great. It's not great. All right, here we go. We're just going to roll with it. If it sounds like crap, oh well. I've thrown a thousand wild punches, and I'm in trouble. I'm falling down through the belly of my father. In a funnel of dark acidic water, clammy clawed fingers reach out, leaving cuts on my wrists. But I should be able to choose. Can you remember my name? Oh, it's hard to say. How did you think I'd respond to a threat? I can't afford to let you see me here. My biggest flaw is my only fear. I disguise it with different faces, but they always end up on the floor. Play with the knobs until something moves. I'm still alive, I'll only admit that to you. Knocked out of the sky by a furtive glance, I need your help to take this chance. I feel like a sheep in wolf's clothing. Like all my fist pumping was for naught. Like a coward Oh, I guess that's what I am. I should be able to choose. So in the lyrics, I just talk about how I internalized everything, where I internalized all my father's, the darkness that I associated with the memories of my dad, or the lack of memories of my dad, I guess. And how I felt, you know, like I was saying, I wish that I could have chosen it, something that I should have, you know, I should be able to choose to not want to hurt myself. I should be able to choose not being that person, not wearing those masks, not being flawed, not being scared, not being hurt. I should be able to have the choice. I should be able to say no. And as a young person, I didn't felt like I did not feel like I had a choice. I felt like I had to feel those things. How I had to feel that way, and I had to respond to life with negativity. And when I got older, I realized that, of course, I did have a choice. I just didn't know it. And I think a lot of young people that are dealing with trauma feel lost in that trauma. They feel like they don't have a choice. I think that's one thing that would have helped me a lot, is if I had went back, like, to Marianne's question earlier. If I had had an opportunity to speak with my younger self, I would have told them that I had a choice. I think additionally, I would have told myself that I can choose how I want to feel. I can choose how I identify myself, how I want to live my life, how I'm able to negotiate my myself, my identity, my problems, conflicts, everything that was in my life. I have a choice. I had that agency. I just didn't know it, and I just didn't have the emotional intelligence enough to realize that, you know, that I was the captain of my own ship. I didn't have to allow other people to define how I felt about myself. I didn't have to do that. I just didn't know anything else. And honestly, like I said before, it was convenient for me to blame myself for everything. I was there. It didn't require that I said anything to anybody. It didn't require that I confronted any problem in my life. I wasn't big on confrontation anyway. So, you know, blaming myself is a confrontation-free exercise. This song is just about not using that same convenient excuse to internalize. It's about questioning it. It's about saying, well, I should have the choice as to whether or not I internalize my negativity and hate myself, or if I love myself and try to live a good life.
Danielle, I just want to say, this is really special. Thank you so much. You know, the depth of the healing and the deep humanism and the hopefulness and, you know, the way in which you're really able to present an alternative to that, you know, hopelessness and this worthlessness, and, you know, and just, you know, being able to create something and really pose the absolute opposite of that is so powerful and so honored. So I really appreciate it. I just want to say, you know, I'm really honored to be working with you and to have known you these years. And it's been really transformative in my own life as well too. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your kindness. It's my honor, my privilege.
You have been listening to the Drama Therapy Collection podcast, part of a series on drama therapy in prisons. You can listen to a new episode every Thursday on all major podcast platforms, or you can watch the video recordings of all interviews on the Drama Therapy Collection YouTube channel.